Good morning. The second case scheduled for oral argument today is State of South Dakota Plaintiff and Appellee versus William J. Janklow, Defendant and Appellant. I'm Glenn Severson, presiding circuit judge for the Second Judicial Circuit with chambers in Sioux Falls. Additional members of the court are Kathleen K. Caldwell, circuit judge for the Second Judicial Circuit with chambers in Sioux Falls. John Bastian, circuit judge for the Fourth Judicial Circuit with chambers in Belle Fouche. Jack R. Von Wald, presiding circuit judge for the Fifth Judicial Circuit with chambers in Aberdeen. Arthur L. Rush, presiding circuit judge for the First Judicial Circuit with chambers in Vermilion. Sitting by appointment for Justices Sabers, Konenkamp, Zinter, and Meyer Henry. I want to welcome the various classes that are appearing today. I understand there are additional classes that are joining us for these arguments from Wagner High School, Andy Central High School, Sanborn Central, and Mitchell Technical Institute. I believe Chief Justice Gilbertson acknowledged the other schools that were here earlier and may still be here. Welcome to all of you this morning. The attorneys appearing today for the appellant are Mr. Edwin E. Evans and Melissa C. Hinton. The attorneys for the state, or attorney for the state, is Patricia Archer. Mr. Evans, I understand you are going to present the argument for Mr. Janklow. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. The first matter I would like to address is whether or not Mr. Janklow's conduct in this case is sufficient to warrant a conviction of the felony of second-degree manslaughter under South Dakota law. To prove second-degree manslaughter, the state must prove the killing was reckless. And reckless is defined as a conscious and unjustifiable disregard of a substantial risk. So what does that mean? And there's two South Dakota Supreme Court cases. And if you read these two cases back to back, it tells us what recklessness means under South Dakota law as interpreted by this court. The first case is State versus Olson. And that's the case where the farmer is driving the tractor down the road and makes a left turn to go onto a gravel road, doesn't see an oncoming vehicle. The oncoming vehicle hits the tractor as it's making an illegal turn in front of it, and the driver of the motor vehicle is killed. And in that case, this court affirmed the dismissal of those charges after a preliminary hearing, and it said that the conduct as a matter of law wasn't reckless. Clearly there was a driver behind the motor vehicle behind the tractor, said that this car was visible, it was coming straight ahead, and the tractor made a left turn right in front of it. He simply didn't see it. There was no excuse offered, wasn't distracted in any way. He simply did not see the oncoming car. The Supreme Court held that although Olson had committed the traffic offense, no doubt about that, and a person was killed, it didn't constitute reckless conduct for purposes of second-degree murder. The court said there's nothing in the evidence, and I'm quoting, quote, there's nothing in the evidence of Olson's behavior to suggest that he was in any way aware of the risk he was creating when he turned his tractor onto the gravel road. Awareness of the risk. And that becomes an important key language when we compare Olson with the later case of State v. Larson. Larson, the Supreme Court affirmed, this court affirmed the conviction of second degree manslaughter. And Larson is the case where the driver is driving through a construction zone and he's speeding and he sees construction workers. Supreme Court said that he's driving through the construction zone at a high rate of speed. He admitted awareness of seeing the construction crew present, and he veered into the closed lane, hitting and killing two construction workers. And again, to quote, the Supreme Court said, Larson's admitted awareness of the crew's presence, coupled with his veering into the closed lane, constitutes recklessness. The distinguishing factor is awareness or knowledge. Obviously, recklessness is more culpable than negligence, more culpable than knew or should have known. Recklessness requires knowledge of a dangerous condition. You have to know about it. Knowledge that an injury is likely, probably going to occur if you don't not act, and that you go ahead and make a conscious decision to act. That's recklessness. The court in Olson recognized that distinction and said there's, and again, the tractor, no evidence that he was aware of the risk. But in Larson, he was aware of the risk. In this case, there's no evidence to prove that Mr. Janklow was aware of the stop sign or of any public vehicle or any vehicle whatsoever within the confines of that intersection as he approached it. He didn't consciously disregard a known risk. He may have been negligent, grossly negligent, obviously was, but no evidence to suggest that he was reckless, that he was consciously aware there's a stop sign. Just like in Larson, he was consciously aware there's construction workers there, and he went into the closed lane. He saw them.
Mr. Evans, you indicate there was no evidence. However, the other acts evidence that was introduced regarding that particular stop sign before, doesn't that go to knowledge of the stop sign and the intersection?
It goes to knowledge on a previous occasion that he knew there was a stop sign was there. I agree. I think the distinguishing factor, if I think about this, is that if I drive home on the same road every night and I know there's a stop sign and I always see it and stop, if sometimes, for whatever reason, I don't stop, is my prior knowledge then mean I'm guilty of second-degree manslaughter? I think by that analysis, then all of a sudden you're elevating a traffic offense of running a stop sign into second-degree manslaughter, because you're saying at some time in the past you knew about this stop sign there. And I think that past acts indicating knowledge of the intersection does show that at some prior time he was aware of the stop sign. But I don't think that transfers into on the day of the accident he consciously, knowingly disregarded a known risk without something there, such as in Larson, where they say Larson admitted knowing the presence of the crew there. He admitted that, and that wasn't an issue. In its brief, interestingly on this point, the state argues that the risk that was disregarded by Mr. Janklow wasn't the stop sign, but was, quote, the potential harm arising out of speeding through the blind intersection. The potential harm. That transfers recklessness back into ordinary negligence. No court ever uses the word potential. Larson didn't, Olson didn't, only the state does. And I want you to think about that. If you apply that to Olson, to the tractor driver, aware of the potential risk, he was obviously aware of a potential risk of turning left in front of oncoming traffic. That just means you knew or should have known. And so the state using the word potential and putting that in there, I think, seriously misconstrues the argument. It's not used by any court. As noted by the court in Olson, the negligent actor fails to perceive a risk that he ought to perceive, fails to see it when he should. The reckless actor perceives and is conscious of the risk, but disregards it. And I suggest to you that the evidence as a matter of law is insufficient on the felony count to establish that against Mr. Janklow.
Mr. Evans.
Yes.
If you would assume that a person who is a diabetic knows the fact that he's not consumed any food for 18 hours, took insulin earlier in the day, knows the repercussions of hypoglycemia, and then he gets behind the wheel of a vehicle and drives that vehicle down the highway under those conditions, could that be legally reckless?
Response is twofold. Number one, I suppose it would depend upon the facts as to whether it could constitute recklessness. I mean, truly, if you had someone that was well aware and knew that they were hypoglycemic and was aware of that, well, my understanding that hypoglycemia impairs your judgment, and that's why it's recognized as a legal defense, but under certain facts, that might be true. That was certainly not the case that we tried in this case. I mean, this case was not tried on that he forgot to eat and didn't eat, and therefore he's guilty of second-degree manslaughter. If that was going to be the issue that was going to be tried, it certainly wasn't tried. I mean, that was something the state said in passing during closing argument, but it was never suggested or argued or evidence to support that theory in this case. It was simply was not an issue, whether or not forgetting to eat can constitute recklessness. And there was no evidence that he consciously made a decision not to eat. That simply wasn't an issue. Couple other things, then I'm going to move on to the motion for new trial. One is the guest statute. Some of you are old enough, as old as me, to remember when we had one. Guest statute, willful and wanton, that is a somewhat comparable term to recklessness. I mean, you look at those guest statute cases and willful and wanton misconduct. You can be driving on the wrong side of the road, speeding, with oncoming traffic coming at you, and that is not willful and wanton misconduct. It's negligence. If you look at those guest statute cases, you could not find Mr. Janklow guilty of second-degree manslaughter in this case, applying the standards that applies in those cases. That's negligence, but it's not a conscious, knowing act, knowing that an injury is going to occur, or
Mr.
that
Evans,
in all likelihood it is.
Why is this question of recklessness not something that was for the jury to decide, that we should defer to the jury's decision?
Because I think it's more comparable to Olson than Larson, in that if you aren't aware, awareness, then as a matter of law, it doesn't constitute second-degree manslaughter. I compare this, as I say, you read Olson and you read Larson, you say, what's the difference and where does this case fit? I happen to personally think that this case falls on the Olson side of the line. The truck driver, there's a risk there to be perceived. Everybody knows that there's a risk there to be perceived, but for some reason, the actor doesn't perceive it. You know, the other thing is, if you look at the state's brief, do they cite one case from any other case in the United States where there's a second-degree manslaughter arising out of facts such as this? Not one case. I mean, they have to rely on Larson and Olson. We cite Cox from Iowa. In Iowa, this case would have been dismissed as a matter of law. Very close, almost directly on point, it would have been dismissed. And look at the state's brief. Not one case from any of the 50 states that would find a felony conviction for second-degree manslaughter under these facts. Motion for new trial. The jury instruction. The primary issue at trial was whether or not Mr. Janklow was reckless, conscious disregard. We spent 5 days of testimony on whether or not Mr. Janklow, being an insulin-dependent diabetic, had the effects of hypoglycemia or low blood sugar that impaired his judgment. 5 days of testimony. It was touched on by almost every single witness. Then after 5 days, the jury was never instructed on the defense. No instruction at all on the defendant's theory of defense. Was he aware? Medical defense was certainly supported by the evidence. The state, as I understand it, takes kind of a shotgun approach. First of all, they say the instructions don't support it. And second, it's not a correct statement of the law. Third, South Dakota wouldn't even recognize this as a defense. The state's first argument ignores all of the substantial evidence. I'm not going to reiterate the facts, but the evidence clearly showed Mr. Janklow was an insulin-dependent diabetic at the time. He took his regular dose of insulin that morning, which is a very large dose. Everybody agrees. He didn't eat on that day of the accident. 6 witnesses came in, and we accounted for every minute of his day. And it wasn't just he, and it wasn't just his chief of staff that was with him all day. It was people that were with him when he was in Aberdeen, and we accounted for every single minute, showed he didn't eat. He passed through Flandreau about 10 minutes before the accident, didn't stop at his mother's house, which he had planned to do for an inexplicable reason. He talked to his brother on his cell phone immediately before the accident, had signs of hypoglycemia, as confirmed by Dr. Loveran, an expert as to what a person, when they slow down their speech and it becomes a bit slurred. The state says, well, he was able to pass a car before the intersection. Dr. Loveran, himself a diabetic and one of the foremost endocrinologists in this area of the country, said, yes, I drove around Minneapolis for 3 hours one day when I was hypoglycemic myself. I couldn't think and I didn't have the judgment to get off the road, But I kept driving. I was able to maintain control of my vehicle.
Mr. Evans, you...
Yes.
Judge Steele didn't give the instruction that you requested. However, the element instruction that he did give did refer to consciousness in at least two different places.
Yes, it did.
And you argued that during closing argument to the jury. How is this not sufficient?
The problem is what does conscious versus unconscious mean? I mean, we could take a poll here today, and I would bet a majority of the people thinks unconscious means in a coma, in a sleep-like state, unconscious. If I get involved in an accident and get hit on the head, unconsciousness means I'm laying there, I'm not aware of my surroundings. That's not what happens with hypoglycemia, and that's not the law. Under the law, we're entitled, and our instructions are attached, to show that unconsciousness doesn't mean being in a coma-like state or asleep. You can
Your
be responsive.
Your instruction didn't really give a definition of consciousness either, did it?
Well, I think it did. You know, and again, if somebody didn't like the wording or whatever, I mean, the state never objected to the wording of it below. The state didn't object at all to the wording. And I think it did. Unconsciousness, as that term is used in these instructions, need not reach the physical dimensions commonly associated with the term, such as a coma. It can exist where the defendant physically acts, in fact, but for reasons such as epilepsy, convulsions, or reflexes, metabolic disorders, which is the insulin-dependent diabetic, is not at the time of acting conscious of his actions. And then we go on and we talk also that the rule of law applies to persons who are not conscious of the acts they perform because they are suffering from hypoglycemia as a result of diabetes. So I do think that it was there, and it was our theory of the case. And I know the South Dakota Supreme Court in Bruder said that you're entitled to be instructed as a matter of due process. In that case, it was Judge Rush's self-defense. You are entitled to that instruction. That's your theory of the case. I mean, our theory of the case, we spent 5 days, both sides debating it, and then our theory of the case was never even instructed on. The simple pattern instruction on consciousness was given. South Dakota has recognized in Jenner, unconsciousness is a defense. In that case, when it adopted that as a defense in a criminal case, it cited the criminal treatise Lefebvre and Scott on criminal law. If you look at the exact section in Lefebvre and Scott that talks about it, they recognize hypoglycemia as a possible legal defense. But no instructions were given on it. And we were entitled to, and the prejudice is self-evident because that was the issue, the central issue at least, in the case.
Was there any expert who testified that the hypoglycemia was equivalent to unconsciousness or the lack of consciousness?
Nobody used the word unconsciousness, but Dr. Lovren and all of them agreed that the signs, you have mild, moderate, and severe hypoglycemia, and you start with mild, and it impairs your judgment, it impairs your mental faculties. They explained how the brain, the food for the brain is sugar. That's what feeds the brain, that's what stimulates us, and there was substantial evidence that one of the first signs of hypoglycemia is impaired judgment, confusion, disorientation, those types of things. And the very first person that encountered Mr. Janklow after the accident, the very first person said he was confused, kind of in a stupor, disoriented, completely symptoms very consistent. Not to mention people are giving him candy bars and Coke and sugar because they're concerned about his diabetes. And sure, then a half an hour later when he talks to somebody, he isn't confused because diabetes corrects, low blood sugar corrects itself within a matter of minutes of getting sugar. And that there's no doubt people saw him, people gave him a Gatorade, people gave him a Coke, people gave him a candy bar, all of that immediately after the accident. That isn't a coincidence. These are people that knew that he had diabetes. And certainly, I'm not saying as a matter of law, but certainly we were entitled to have the jury consider that after 5 days of testimony on that issue. And the jury needed some guidance on that issue, not merely to say a conscious disregard when you know, that means we have to show he's unconscious. What does that mean? I wouldn't know what that meant if I didn't look it up under the law, that meaning. Prior bad acts. I realize the court has considerable discretion, the trial court, on evidentiary issues, but here those other acts were used for exactly the reasons that are prohibited by the rule. Propensity. The Trooper Talsma incident, where a year earlier, we're in Rapid City, there's no stop sign, there's no intersection, there's no accident, the defendant never left his lane of travel, but he speeds through a construction zone.
Mr. Evans.
The Walters incident was particularly prejudicial. That's the one that happened 6 months earlier at the same intersection. And let me tell you what the prosecutor did with that after using that. This is what he said in closing argument. You know what happened on December 29, that's this earlier incident at the intersection. The stop sign that he passed didn't stop him. The first set of rumble bars didn't stop him. The second set of rumble bars didn't stop him. The stop sign didn't stop him. Nothing could stop him. Nothing could stop him, maybe today. He asked the jury to convict Mr. Janklow of second-degree manslaughter for the incident that occurred back on December 29th. Maybe today, he says, you'll convict him for what happened back then. That is such an abuse, an obvious abuse of prior bad acts, and the prejudice is self-evident. Cumulative effect, think about this. We spend 5 days, no instructions given on the theory of defense, prior bad acts all come in, and he's tried on those, and then the prosecutor comments that our defense is made up on the eve of trial, which was a false statement. We had disclosed it properly, and so for all of those reasons, a new trial should be granted. The cumulative effect of those errors that intertwine and relate to each other. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Ms. Archer, 20 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'd like to start this morning by first noting that what happened on August 16, 2003 was no accident. I'm not saying it was intentional, but the bottom line is that this was a reckless killing of Randy Scott, who died because the defendant ran a stop sign and entered a blind intersection without stopping and looking for oncoming traffic. Now let's talk about the recklessness of the defendant's behavior that day. As counsel pointed out, the state had the burden of proving that the defendant recklessly killed Randy Scott. And in doing so, the state had the burden of proving that he did it recklessly, which means a conscious and unjustifiable disregard of a substantial risk that one's conduct may cause a certain result or may be of a certain nature. The counsel wants to talk about knowledge. Counsel wants to talk about that the defendant had to have known that he would cause or could cause. That's not the definition. The state has to show that the defendant was aware of that risk. The risk was not any individual aspect of that scene that day. The risk was the totality of that scene. And that awareness of that risk can be proved by the state indirectly. The state didn't have to prove that the defendant saw the stop sign, although there was evidence in the record that the defendant did see the stop sign out of the defendant's own mouth. He said, and if you listen to that and watch that videotape, State's Exhibit Number 26, he's explaining to Trooper Lanning what happened. This is 2 hours after the incident. And he said, I was slowing down for that stop sign. But the state doesn't even have to prove that the defendant saw the stop sign. The state doesn't have to prove that the defendant saw the motorcyclist, Randy Scott, coming from the east. Defendant's awareness of the risk can be proved indirectly, as demonstrated by the defendant's conduct. And that is his reckless disregard for the safety of others and his indifference to the consequences of his acts. The same case law that the counsel is citing, Olson and Larson, supports the state's position on that. The risk that defendant disregarded in this case was his speeding through a blind intersection, not stopping at the stop sign. This is two highways, and without stopping and looking for oncoming traffic. The totality of all those circumstances was the risk that the defendant ignored in this case. Now, standing separately, individually, each factor might not support a conviction for reckless manslaughter. However, the totality of the circumstances does. And the state would submit, even if the court wants to assume the defendant did not see the stop sign, forget the stop sign. Even if there had been no stop sign at that intersection, this is an intersection of two highways, 55 mile per hour traffic. There's a cornfield that creates a blind spot that prevents a motorist coming southbound from seeing what's coming from the east. Not stopping at that intersection and looking to see if there's traffic shows a disregard of the safety of others and shows an indifference to the consequences of his acts.
But not all people who run stop signs and kill somebody are tried for manslaughter or found guilty. So how does, if you're saying that just disregarding the stop sign is enough, and clearly it isn't, so what makes this different?
Again, Your Honor, it's the totality of all the circumstances that were present on that day and at that intersection, and coupled with the defendant's particular knowledge of that intersection and his particular knowledge of the dangerousness of that intersection when one goes through it without stopping. This is not just a case of a single traffic violation that we're relying on, that the state is relying on in this case. We're relying on the totality of the circumstances. And I think under Larson, that's clearly supportable. And again, the Olson case that counsel relies on was a situation where this court deferred to a trial court's decision to dismiss the case. That was the appropriate standard of proof in that, burden and standard of review in that case. This court gave deference to that finding below. Now we're in this case. The jury has spoken. The jury has rejected the defendant's case. The jury has found him guilty. The appropriate standard for this court is not to review the evidence again, not to reweigh the credibility of the witnesses, but it is to look in the record and determine whether there is sufficient evidence in the record to support that jury's finding. And clearly there is. And we would ask the court to uphold that finding.
What about the statements of one of the prosecutors on raising the community conscious argument that Mr. Evans just alluded to? Isn't that clearly inappropriate conduct for a prosecutor?
Generally speaking, Your Honor, community conscience arguments are inappropriate. But I believe a person has to look at this in the context.
Well, in context, he was using 404B evidence that was allowed by Judge Steele for a very specific purpose and commented on that evidence as the last statement in closing argument. Isn't the purpose or the job of a prosecutor the same as a court to assure that the defendant receives a fair trial? Didn't the prosecutor step over the line with those comments?
Your Honor, I don't believe he did.
How could he not have?
Using comments about evidence that has been properly admitted is totally appropriate in a closing.
It was admitted for a limited purpose, however. He used it for another purpose.
Well, I guess I disagree with the purpose that the counsel is urging. In this case, what the prosecutor did was basically say, you know what can stop him, and this is your county, these are your communities, these are your roads. I just don't believe that has crossed the line into community conscious argument. Some of the cases that have discussed community conscious suggest that the prosecutor has used reprehensible methods of argument, asking the jury to put themselves in the shoes of the victim, asking the jury to consider hypothetical harm to themselves. None of that happened here. This just simply didn't cross that line into that realm. And also, it should be noted that the trial court instructed the jury with instruction number 24 as to the limited purpose for the other act's evidence. And they were told that repeatedly. And so I believe that it was clear to the jury what they could use that evidence for. And the prosecutor noted what it could use that evidence for.
We all know that the community conscious type argument is impermissible. Do we have any cases that set out a bright line as far as what is a community conscious consciousness argument that's not permissible?
Again, you know, one can look at some of the case law in the state and see, you know, where the court has held that it to be impermissible and where it has been held to be okay. I think one of the cases where the prosecutor probably crossed the line, or at least this court indicated that the prosecutor crossed the line, was, you know, by exerting foul blows, if you will, in their closing, was State v. Smith. That wasn't necessarily a community conscious argument, but that was a prosecutorial misconduct issue. And the court said, you know, there the prosecutor had referred to the defendant as a monster and a pervert, the repeated references throughout the closing about the defendant. The court had said, you know, this was too much, this was had inflamed the jury. However, the court had noted there was no prejudice. Similarly, I think in the Blaine case, where the prosecutor had argued facts not in evidence, had asked the jury to consider hypothetical harm to the jury, the court had held that was probably, you know, impermissible. But again, there's no prejudice. And in this case, I guess I would note initially, throughout these comments that were supposedly so horrible and so inflammatory, there was no objection at all by counsel. And in fact, the community conscious objection didn't even arise until much later, I think, for the motion for new trial. So you have to be able to give the trial judge the opportunity to make a correction during the argument, I mean, during the trial. And so I would state all initially that the issue is not properly preserved. But secondly, there's no prejudice, and the court obviously felt that the trial court, was in the best position to decide whether or not there had been any kind of impermissible impact on the jury, and had denied the motion for new trial, so obviously decided that that was not the case.
What about the failure to give the defendant's jury instruction on consciousness? What we have to find is that the case would have come out different, that there would be a different verdict if those instructions had been given. And I'd like you to address that the failure to give the definition of consciousness. As Mr. Evans said, most people wouldn't know what consciousness in the eyes of the law is or is not.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the trial court felt that a common sense understanding of the word should prevail, and I believe that that is totally acceptable in this case. What we have is a proposal, two proposals. Number 16 was essentially the theory of the case, their proposed theory of the case, that the rule about consciousness, or that a person is not criminally culpable if they're not conscious of their actions, applies where they are suffering from hypoglycemia as a result of diabetes. Proposed number 15 was the definitional instruction that the defendant proposed. And, you know, these two are the definitions, or these two are the instructions that the defendant proposed. It's not up to the state to start tinkering with the language of what could be, it should be there. This is the proposal, and it was up to the court to decide if they were appropriate. The language as proposed was not appropriate in this case, and this is why. Let's talk about number 15, the definitional instruction. What that instruction said, essentially, is that unconsciousness need not reach the physical dimensions commonly associated with the term such as coma. It can exist where the defendant physically acts in fact, but for reasons such as epilepsy and other convulsions and reflexes, metabolic disorders and hypnotic states, is not at the time of acting conscious of his actions. First of all, there's absolutely no evidence in the record whatsoever about epilepsy, convulsions, and reflexes in hypnotic states. So that kind of language is inappropriate in this case. The other thing, probably more importantly, is it doesn't define what conscious is. It might possibly suggest what consciousness isn't. But we still don't have a definition of conscious. And not only that, it basically says that unconsciousness can exist when you're not conscious. I don't know how that clarifies anything for the jury, and it leaves the word conscious there still undefined. Not once is there a definition provided for conscious. I think that the common sense interpretation of the word conscience is sufficient, and I think we can give the jury some credit here. Now, counsel and defendant claims that without this instruction, the jury could reasonably assume that the defendant had to have been asleep or in a coma. And first of all, nobody suggested that the defendant had to be in a coma in order to get the benefit of the instruction. And number two, I think any reasonable juror would know that if someone is facing a reckless manslaughter charge, sitting through 6 days of trial, it was stemming from an incident involving his driving, that nobody would have believed that he was in a coma, laying out in a coma at the time of the offense.
But isn't that the common sense definition of unconsciousness, that you're in a coma or laying on the ground not knowing what's happening? How many people would think that unconscious behavior is going to be somebody that could still be driving a car?
Well, again, Your Honor, I think the common sense, a common definition or common interpretation of it is, as I've heard being mentioned, I've seen it being mentioned in counsel's brief, talking about awareness. And maybe that would have been an appropriate word, but not once in any of the defendant's proposals did we see a definition that would talk about that. And I guess, I would rely partially on the fact that the instructions that were given, having to do with recklessness and the fact that the state must prove the defendant acted consciously, has been used throughout the state in many contexts, and jurors have been able to make judgments based on those instructions in the past. Again, the proposals as brought to the court were too broad, they were too confusing, they were not supported by the facts, and they were adequately covered by the instructions that the court did give. This is unique in that this is a case for reckless killing. The state had the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant acted consciously. Not every criminal case has that, but this case did. And so the state had to prove consciousness. The jury was already instructed by that through the essential elements instruction, as well as instructions 20 and 31, which told the jury that it must find beyond a reasonable doubt every element, and that it must acquit if it had any reasonable doubt upon any single material fact that constituted the offense. The defendant basically got his instructions. Now, he didn't get the hypoglycemia one, but that was not supported by the facts. And I'll talk about that. It is clear that even for instructions on your theory of your defense, they are only properly given if the instruction is supported by the facts. Here, there was lengthy testimony about the issue of hypoglycemia, but there was no testimony, none, especially none from defendant's witnesses, that said he was unconscious at the time of the offense. There's a difference between having hypoglycemia and being unconscious. And again, looking at the language of the instruction as proposed, it says merely hypoglycemia.
So you're equating unconsciousness with totally being not aware of the circumstances, not unaware. You're totally out. That's your definition of unconscious.
I would say that it is not merely hypoglycemic. If you want to say an advanced stage of hypoglycemia or even a moderate stage, I don't know. But what I'm saying is, as proposed, by merely using the language hypoglycemia, that doesn't cut it. This defendant had hypoglycemia.
There was no evidence. There was extensive testimony from Dr. Lovren, as well as even the testimony of the state's witness, acknowledged that there would have been hypoglycemia under the facts as presented to him in cross-examination.
Certainly, the experts had a clinical opinion that, given a certain set of assumptions, the defendant would likely have been hypoglycemic at the time of the offense.
2 minutes.
However, I think the expert, especially Dr. Lovren, was not, at least in the record, it's not clear from the record that he was aware of the critical moments leading up to that crash. And this is what the defendant was doing. This is why it's clear from the record that he was, in fact, conscious. He was engaged in conversation, active conversation with Chris Branlin. Branlin, who's been with the defendant for years, probably been with him more than his own family, said that the defendant was acting fine, he had no concerns right up to the crash. He agreed everything was hunky-dory. Even if, again, going with the defendant's argument that his symptoms were masked and he didn't recognize them himself, you've got Chris Branlin sitting right next to you. They're trying to convince the court that the defendant went from being fine to unconsciousness within a matter of very short time, and Chris Branlin doesn't see anything wrong. But more importantly, we see that within minutes he's engaged in conversation, he's driving a car, and he's performing. He passes Monica Collins at a high rate of speed, totally successfully. No erratic driving, performs it beautifully. And his own expert said that this is not something he would expect a hypoglycemic person to be able to do successfully. Finally, you've got him at this last split second. He yells out a warning to Branlin, "Look out!" And he slams on his brakes. His own expert testified that those brakes were fully engaged. The defendant had hit the brakes. Now, somebody who was unconscious, even under the defendant's proposed theory, would not have had even enough awareness to be doing that. That's the state's position.
Time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Evans, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Going to this last point first, the proposed instruction, first of all, I would invite you to read and draw your own conclusions from the transcript. Chris Branlin said that things seemed fine, but he was more quiet than usual. Usually he's talkative, and he was fairly quiet, except making a comment about his mom's house and a corner and a farm. He was much more quiet than usual. His brother, the state conveniently overlooks his brother, that said that he sounded kind of lethargic and sounded different on the phone. That's all undisputed. The state simply ignores evidence that was there to support that instruction and support unconsciousness. The state's argument is that, number one, there's no evidence to support it. Number two, hypoglycemia can't be a defense as a matter of law. Number three, common sense tells us what consciousness versus unconsciousness is. Number four, the language isn't appropriate because we mentioned epilepsy. Think about this for a minute. It's kind of like the farmer that owned a goat, and the neighbor, his cabbages are being eaten, and the farmer's defense is, number one, I don't own a goat. Number two, you don't own any cabbages. Number three, if you own cabbages and I own a goat, my goat wasn't on your property. And number four, if I own a goat and you own cabbages and your cabbages got eaten and my goat was on your property, my goat didn't eat them. I mean, they go to every length, and that tells you something about their case, it was a proper statement of the law. It's not objectionable because it happens to mention the word epilepsy. That's maybe an appropriate example. One can argue that if it solely talked about hypoglycemia, and one of the instructions did and didn't talk about epilepsy, but that didn't make any difference, and often pattern instructions talk about things and give things as way of examples, that doesn't make it objectionable just because epilepsy is mentioned. And that's what happens when, I guess, you copy word for word from a case law so that the court knows that you aren't making something up, and you put it in exactly like the court says and use the court's language.
Mr. Evans?
Yes.
Did you have any expert testimony that stated that the defendant was not conscious due to hypoglycemia?
We had expert testimony. Again, did they use the word unconscious? No, because that's a legal term of art. They said that his medical judgment would be impaired and that he would not be conscious of a stop sign and not be conscious that he was driving through the stop sign, not consciously aware of that. Yes.
Did anyone define consciousness for the jury, any of your experts?
No. From a medical standpoint, they talk about confusion and the sugar that, you know, impacts the brain and whatever, but they never said the legal definition of conscious or unconscious is as follows. They talked in medical terms and not legal terms, which, again, was important why we needed the term defined from a legal standpoint as to what unconscious means under the law, that it can be, you know, if you don't want to talk about hypoglycemia, that it can be epilepsy or those types of things, or a seizure or whatever that lay people may not understand fits the definition of unconsciousness under the law. Couple of other quick things. Going back to the motion for a judgment of acquittal, she says, well, they don't have any direct evidence of recklessness. That's the state's position. No direct evidence, but they have indirect evidence. Again, under Olson, you need direct evidence because the reckless actor perceives or is conscious of the risk and then knowingly disregards it. That's the mens rea, that's the state of mind requirement. Under the state's theory, as I understand it, there need not even be a stop sign there and he'd be guilty. Wow. No stop sign and he'd still be guilty of second degree manslaughter because of a cornfield that made it blind for both drivers. Again, no cases, none, in South Dakota. I mean, if we look at Olson and Larson, and no cases anywhere in the country do they cite that would support second degree manslaughter under these circumstances. Not one has been presented to you in their brief or during argument. Community conscious argument. It's disappointing for the Attorney General's Office of the state to say that all of those comments were appropriate and that they see nothing wrong with them. I would at least hope that they would have said that in hindsight they shouldn't have been used. But the state's position in this case is that that's the way they want prosecutors to try cases. That's what they're telling you. And this court should not approve that message. Plain error. In August of this year, this court even adopted plain error in civil cases. Colcraft case. And in Colcraft, they cite State versus Nelson as the standard in criminal cases. Plain error requires an error. There's no doubt that saying that they should convict him for prior bad acts and that, ladies and gentlemen, you have to drive on these roads. You decide if you want him out there. No doubt about it that that's error. Number two, it's plain. No doubt about it, it's plain error. Prosecutors know better. Number three, it affects substantial rights. That's undisputed. It affects a person's liberty in this case. Number four, it seriously affects the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of the judicial proceedings, and I think that's probably the most important one.
Was plain error raised with the trial court after the fact? Was that argued with
no.
the trial court?
No, because we made a motion for a mistrial, and when the motion for mistrial was denied, we asked for a curative instruction, and that was denied as well. So we did not, plain error was not presented to the trial court. But I mean, if the state's position is that this is an appropriate conduct for prosecutors and are on record for that, I think that that last one, that the public reputation deserves some consideration by this court. Um, In conclusion, I want to go back to the cumulative effect of this, because I do think that this is a key. You know, we can say that no defendant obviously is entitled to a perfect trial, and there's going to be times where a better instruction could have been given, or things could have been handled a little differently. But the nightmare that this defendant, Mr. Janklow, was faced with, he's entitled to a fair trial, and that was difficult enough to start with. I don't have to tell you that, just because of the overwhelming publicity and interest, which is fine. But he is entitled to a fair trial. He has a medical defense. A medical defense that their expert said if he didn't eat and he took his insulin, there was a high degree of medical probability that he would have had hypoglycemia and been impaired at the time of the accident. We have the county coroner, Dr. Jacobs, that was out there examined him. And although he didn't make a diagnosis, he said he had several symptoms compatible, confusion, agitation, several symptoms that were compatible.
Aren't those also compatible with just getting in a terrible car accident? I mean, couldn't the jury have found that instead?
Could have, but we're entitled to present our defense, and we're entitled to have the court instruct. We aren't saying as a matter of law, we're saying that we're entitled to that instruction. And after all of that medical testimony for a week by both sides, there's no instruction on our theory of the case, none. The state's attorney says that the medical defense was concocted on the eve of trial, when that was a false statement. Our defense had been disclosed before the deadline that the court sent for disclosing experts and their opinions. And then they focus on prior charges and say he had a propensity to commit this. And even if he was hypoglycemic on the day of the accident for which he's charged, he wasn't 6 months earlier when he almost hit the Walters family. And that was Russian roulette, and a blank went off there. And that maybe today you'll get him for what happened there. You put all that together, and the prejudice is overwhelming and irrefutable, and it was impossible to overcome. For all of those reasons, Your Honor, we would first of all urge a reversal and dismissal of the felony count of manslaughter, second degree, or in the alternative, a new trial on the charges as well for the reasons urged. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Thank you, Ms. Archer. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.